provides app-based mobility to small businesses, to individuals, and to communities in cities like Lagos, Accra, and we're gradually expanding and launching other cities in West Africa. Mobility and last mile logistics, and logistics in general, is one of the biggest challenges that Africa faces today. And at the heart of economic development and economic growth and prosperity for people anywhere in the world is a very efficient and affordable and accessible logistics and mobility system. And how Max is bridging that gap in Africa today is, of course, by leveraging mobile technology to connect users with providers. Beyond that also is the fact that we're taking away friction. So payments, for example, integrating with companies like Followweb allows us to take away a lot of cash-based payments, improve security, because drivers moving around with cash also makes them targets for thieves, right? So eliminating all of that is extremely important in ensuring and guaranteeing security. And last but not least, also is a lot of the work we do around financing drivers, providing them access to credit to be able to own their own motorcycles and their vehicles over a short period of time, and also providing them training that is so important.
Now, for more analysis on the rapid rise of African startups, we have contacted Musach Obioha, the Executive Director of Ventures Platform Foundation, and Mr. Amin Yusuf, the co-founder of Afrobytes, an international tech marketplace connecting businesses and technology leaders, founders, investors, policy experts, and the media with the African tech industry. Now, thanks a lot, gentlemen, for your time. Let's start off with Mr. Obioha. Now, what's the reason behind the resounding success by African startups?
The first is, so Africa is a very large market. Beyond the size of the market, there's been a lot of underdevelopment in most of Africa, which also presents huge opportunities. Technically, if you know anything about entrepreneurs, is entrepreneurship is all about solving problems and wrapping sustainable business models around the solutions to those problems. So anywhere you see a lot of problems, the tendency is to see a lot of entrepreneurship and a lot of resilience and a lot of people trying to create innovative solutions and wrapping business models around those solutions. So for Africa, having a plethora of problems and having huge human capital, it just clearly means that there's going to be a lot of solutions coming out and people innovating and creating these types of solutions. So that's one of the reasons why there's been a boom with innovation entrepreneurship ecosystem in Africa, and having lots of startups coming up. I think also the availability of digital penetration through telecommunications companies also has made it possible to have information spread super fast, have communication happen super fast.
Thanks for that. Now, what makes African startups attractive to foreign investors, and what potential do they see here?
They are looking for new frontiers and new markets, and Africa looks like a very great place to be, a very great place to invest. And for them, it's not about preaching, it's more like preaching to the choir, because they already see the potential of those types of investment in their own markets. While here, for many local investors, it's quite foreign for them to understand how you could own a little amount of equity in a startup and startup can grow super fast, and then be able to exit either through an acquisition. And one of the very interesting examples is how recently Paystack exited with an acquisition from Stripe at $200 million after just about 5 years of operation. Now, a traditional investor would not be able to understand how someone can build a company in 5 years and exit at $200 million, or how today Flutterwave, which is another fintech startup in Nigeria, is also worth over $1 billion. So these are concepts that have been quite difficult for local investors to comprehend and to grasp. And that's why platforms like my platform, one of the things that we do actively is we try to get traditional investors and teach them and try to educate them on the innovation and startup ecosystem and how investment here is done and how the upsides can be incredible.
In Africa, digital innovation is transforming the agriculture by improving food production, providing agribusiness opportunities, and making agriculture attractive for young people seeking employment as well. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations is involved in a project that has developed apps for smart farming in some African countries. Let's see how one of the apps works for farmers.
In Rwanda and Senegal, the FAO has partnered with local farmers and innovators to develop and pilot four new mobile apps that are making making a difference in the lives and livelihoods of farmers. The four apps have voice and text features and can be used on smart and feature phones. The first app, called Cure and Feed Your Livestock, provides farmers with real-time information and advice on animal disease control and animal feeding strategies. It includes a vaccination calendar and a list of local veterinarians and shows water points and pasture maps.
Urabibabwira uti ni agira icyo kibazo mu veterinary utamubona shyiramo ibimenyetso ubona bazakubwira icyo ugomba gukora.
Mr. Obioha, can you elaborate on how some of these startups are having direct impact on the lives of African people?
These startups are able to create solutions that are now affecting the lives of many people. Whether it's in payment or it's in healthcare, one incredible startup that I heard about recently is MDAS. They've been able to create this well-equipped medical diagnostic centers, but using refurbished equipment. But what they've also done is they're able to service multiple hospitals. So while one hospital has equipment for their own customer base, which is quite limited, what they've been able to do is aggregate a lot of hospitals to use one medical center or one diagnostic center. And what this has been able to do is it increased the number of people that can access medical diagnostic services, but also has reduced the price of the services, therefore getting in more access to more people.
Now, that's great. African startups are improving the lives of African people. That's another reason to be hopeful about Africa's future. Let's now bring in Mr. Amin Yusuf, a co-founder of Afrobytes. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Yusuf. Now, how is the increase in new business startups in Africa helping ordinary people improve their livelihoods?
I think the first sector I'm thinking about is definitely finance and access to finance, access to banking. Take the example of Kenya. They had a problem of unbanked people. And when the mobile money came, it helped a lot of people to be financially included. That means more transactions, that means more payments, that means that they had access to goods, so that was very important. And for example, now, I think that the volume of transactions in fintech in Kenya is more than 50% of the GDP. That's just really huge.
Now, what are some of the major challenges that African startups have faced over the past year?
Okay. So I think one of the bigger challenges that they faced wasn't even the pandemic itself, but was like the restrictions that came with the pandemic. And those more nuanced effects have affected a lot of startups. One is spending patterns of people changed because people had new priorities, so people were not buying what they used to buy before. So a lot of startups have had to try to better understand their customer base now to figure out where to pivot to. Another thing was the lockdown was really brutal on Nigeria, for one, because a lot of people lost livelihoods, a lot of businesses shut down, a lot of people lost their jobs, and so the purchasing power of many of the people reduced, which also meant that they were not able to buy the normal services that they would normally purchase, which automatically reduced the amount of money that the startups could make, which obviously affected them negatively.
Tibu Health, a Kenyan health startup, is a classic case turning threats into opportunities. This app is gaining popularity in the country's capital, Nairobi, for providing home-based medical care. Tibu app was launched nearly 1 year ago at the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic that forced many to stay at home. Let's have a look.
The age of the app means taxis and takeaways can be brought to your door at the touch of a button. But in a home in Nairobi, Natalie Maikere is requesting a different home delivery. Via Tibu's Health app, she's just ordered a doctor.
What I really like about it is it takes 15, 30 minutes. So when the first time I used it, it was for me. Normally, I never go to the hospital because it takes too much time. But this time, I didn't hesitate. I was like, oh, this is easy. I just call a doctor and it comes.
Have you ever had this headache before?
With 600 customers in Nairobi, Tibu is a small player in a global movement towards home-based medical care.
Despite the lockdown and job losses, several startups made massive profits. How was this possible?
For some businesses, it was super, super I'm positive for them, especially businesses around remittances or businesses that were into foreign investments in Nigeria. So we saw some of those companies increase and grow in revenue. And by one program that we were running, the FinTech Accelerator program, we had one of the companies there that was into remittances and into international investments, and they grew from less than $10,000 in asset under management over $2 million in about 2 to 3 months.
Well, from our conversation today, it's quite clear that Africa is a new frontier for startups. The population there is young and eager to embrace new technologies, and this creates a great opportunity for startups. That wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you, and on behalf of my colleagues here at Africa Today, it's goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. Having competent managers and benefiting from capacities are necessary conditions for economic blossoming.
I want to say to the Iranian nation that because of some problems in the economic situation and in the people's livelihood conditions, some individuals have used the opportunity to fabricate negative stories, saying things such as nothing can be done in any way. Some people are like this. Some individuals in cyberspace, in our press and primarily, and unfortunately in foreign propaganda networks, use the problems that the people face as a means to portray a completely dark picture of the things conveying the feeling that nothing can be done. However, I will tell you that this is not all the case. With its domestic capacities and capabilities, our economy can be one of the most prospering economies in the region and even in the world. We have many capacities. We have numerous resources, and using these resources does not require any miracle whatsoever. These are the issues which could be resolved by officials and managers with determination a sense of responsibility and great endeavor.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The condition for this is to have strong and anti-corruption management in the country, as well as comprehensive economic plan. If these things exist, then these capacities should be exploited. The World Bank experts are saying now, it is not what we claim, rather this is being said by well-known and first-tier economists in the world, working as experts for the World Bank, that Iran's economy is 18th among the best economies in the world. In other words, we are the 18th economy among 200 plus countries in the world, and that has been achieved despite the current sanctions and numerous problems. They say that if untapped capacities are used, later on, I will mention these capacities, Iran's economy will move up 6 spots, rising to the 12th position. This is a very important point. With an 80 plus million population, and despite all these problems that others have imposed on us, sanctions and the like, the country is thankfully alive and up and running, and it is also the 18th economy in the world. This is not a minor achievement. We should pay attention to this.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
In the limelight.
Wireless equipment now consumes annually 40% of all chip value produced in the world. The industry is now embedded in the global economy, and some countries are now benefiting from untold numbers of businesses around the world. We now present you an article written by Henry Kressel, a technologist, inventor, and long-term Warburg Pincus private equity investor, under the heading Communications, the Once and Future Next Big Thing. The article has been taken from the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Henry Kressel's article. To stimulate economic growth through technology investment is a continuing discussion. So a commonly asked question is, what is the next big technology thing that will create major new economic opportunities? I believe that the first place to look is investing in communications technology, because the historical record shows that breakthrough innovations in communications technology that substantially increase the ability of people to interact and conduct business are key drivers of economic growth. To support this conclusion, consider five major developments in electronic communications that had profoundly important consequences, starting with the electrical telegraph. The first electronic communication system was the telegraph link, developed by Samuel Morse and demonstrated in 1844. In addition to enabling rapid long-distance personal and business communications, the telegraph lines along railroad tracks revolutionized the ability to synchronize train traffic over big networks. As big railroad networks proved their economic value, their construction generated investment booms that lasted decades as railroads, in the second half of the 19th century, proliferated around the world. The second big communications breakthrough was the telephone that was introduced in the 1870s. Telephony set the stage for numerous new businesses and services, but an important consequence was the consolidation of the industry. Because overlapping competing telephony networks were ruinous, to ensure national service, AT&T was established as a U.S. monopoly. The company was responsible for decades of contributions through Bell Laboratory Research and its many service subsidiaries. Its monopoly position and consistent profits allowed the company to conduct long-range research, and the transistor was one of the results. I think of this momentous invention as the offspring of the telephony industry, since it was funded through the profits of that industry. The invention of the transistor at Bell Laboratories in 1948 opened the digital computation era and led to all subsequent communications innovations that relied on computer operation. But it took a team of innovators to go to the next stage of exploiting the transistor value in computation. A team of scientists, including former Bell Laboratories people, saw the market opportunity opened by digital circuits and founded Intel. The business plan was about one page long and defined no specifics. Intel created the integrated circuit market, and its microprocessor chips were increasingly valuable in large part because of their use in growing digital communication networks of increasing data-carrying capacity. Again, we see the impact of communications on business development, so a key enabler of Intel's growth was the fact that ever larger computer communication networks linking ever more powerful computers were being built, thus creating a demand for increasingly powerful Intel data processing chips. But the long-distance data-carrying capabilities of networks was being limited by the available technology that relied on copper or coaxial transmission lines. This brings us to our third communications technology breakthrough that eventually solved that problem. This data rate limitation was overcome in the 1970s by fiber optic communications technology, which used light transmission through thin glass lines with lasers providing the light pulses. It took years of development, but by the 1990s, multi-gigabit fiber optic systems were being deployed globally, enabling the Internet, our fourth communications breakthrough. The internet had its roots in the idea of communication networks based on digital data packets, provided with headers for addressing and moving through computer routers that read their destination addresses and moved the packets to their destination through multiple hops. Fiber optic links combined with high-speed processing chips at routers enabled gigabit networks that had not been practical with prior copper-based transmission lines. So the modern internet was born, and we have witnessed thousands of new companies since the late 1990s that have leveraged its capability to provide new services that now dominate US economy, such as Amazon.com, Google, and Facebook. The internet has left few industries alone. Witness Netflix, which using internet distribution successfully competes with cable access to the home, a business that was deemed as impregnable monopoly. For the next big development, we go to our fifth breakthrough, ubiquitous two-way consumer wireless communications. Wireless communication was demonstrated in the late 19th century, but it took until the 1990s for two-way service at affordable consumer rates to become a mass service with billions of subscribers globally. As a measure of its importance, wireless equipment now consumes annually 40% of all the chip value produced in the world. The industry is now embedded in the global economy, and some countries are now benefiting untold numbers of businesses around the world. Of course, easy internet access had to be developed, so here wireless technology played a key role. Internet access needs local networks, and a world without Wi-Fi is unthinkable. It has transformed the way people shop and people communicate. What we have described is a historical process in which new communications technologies enabled world-changing economic development. But the process is always painful, with winners and losers galore. Identifying breakthrough communication technologies is the easy part. Exploiting market opportunities after revolutionary technologies emerge is where winners and losers part company. For example, wireless telephones became highly popular after the 1990s, but the industry leaders of the time, Nokia and Motorola, focused on cost reduction of handsets and missed the market. Both went out of the handset business. One lesson from history is that breakthrough technologies may emerge slowly in the face of skepticism that stops companies from taking them seriously until it is too late. Extensive and costly private and government investment is needed over years. For example, for fiber optic communications industry conferences in the late 1970s included discussions dismissing their use in undersea cables because of inadequate reliability. Corning persevered in the fiber market, becoming the world leader. Let me note that sometimes going against accepted wisdom can be rewarding. My favorite example involves an investment we made at Warburg Pincus in a company called Level One Communications in the late 1980s. Its proprietary technology allowed transmitting megabit rate digital data on ordinary twisted pair telephone copper lines. There was common belief that computer data would be transmitted over fiber optic links in office environments. On the other hand, we believed that if megabits of data per second could be transmitted for short distances over phone lines, the lower cost and ease of installation of copper lines would ensure a large market for local office digital data distribution. This turned out to be correct, in fact, as Ethernet became a standard at 10 megabits per second over copper lines. And being early, Level 1 captured a large share of the market for chips enabling the service. But where are we today in breakthrough communications technology? Is there a number 6? It is still early to say, but the new 5th generation wireless technology rolling out across the world is likely to fit the category, because it ushers in the age of widespread wireless machine networks. The reason is that 5th generation greatly improves the data carrying capacity of wireless networks and is well suited for machine-to-machine wireless communications, enabling remote high-speed data interconnections previously impractical. For example, this will enable robotic operations remotely controlled through wireless connectivity and machine maintenance service remotely. One much-discussed application that could revolutionize transportation is driverless vehicles. Other applications in manufacturing and remote sensing, as well as remote medical system monitoring, will greatly reduce business costs. But that will be true only for companies prepared to invest and use this new technology. And government support for communications infrastructure is critical, because it is a vital economic asset for growth. But this has always been the case. Companies either invest in the future or they disappear.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The debate.
The Kremlin has warned NATO that any plan to deploy more troops to Ukraine would further escalate tensions near Russia's borders, and Russia would be forced to take extra measures to ensure its own security too. Moscow's response came after Washington warned Russia last week against what it called intimidation and pledged to stand by Ukraine in the event of any aggression. Moscow pointed out that any attempt spearheaded by the West to start a new military conflict in Ukraine's east would culminate in the destruction of the country. Russia's relations with the West have soured in the past several years over a range of issues, including accusations of election meddling and human rights. Sergei Lavrov says his country's ties with the U.S. and Europe have hit the absolute bottom.
The West and Russia are on a collision course again over Ukraine. The Kremlin has warned the Western military alliance NATO that any deployment of troops along the Ukrainian border with Russia would deteriorate the situation further. Moscow says it would be forced to take extra measures to ensure its own security if the U.S.-led NATO sends troops in support of Ukraine. That, a day after the Ukrainian president accused Russia of building up troops along the border amid renewed clashes between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian militias. Russia says its military presence on the border is not meant to threaten Ukraine. Moscow's response came after the U.S. warned last week against what it called Russian intimidation and pledged to stand by Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine have had a conflict centered on Crimea and Donbas regions since 2014. Tensions surfaced with Kiev and Moscow recently trading blame for a spike in violence in eastern Ukraine. In a recent meeting, NATO ambassadors condemned what they called Moscow's military buildup near Ukraine. However, the Russia foreign minister says the U.S.-led anti-Russia NATO campaign will ultimately destroy Ukraine.
Judging by the information published by the media, the majority of Ukrainian military forces understand the fatality of any actions leading to a hot conflict. I very much hope that they will not be incited by politicians, who in turn will be incited by the West, led by the United States.
The U.S. and European leaders are losing no time to denounce and threaten Russia, citing Ukraine. Tensions have been running high ever since Ukraine's Crimea region re-entered into Russia following a referendum. Since then, NATO has been expanding its Eastern Front. The United States missile systems in Romania and Poland, as well as American soldiers and military hardware in the region, are part of the military alliance game plan. Latvia and Lithuania are among destinations where NATO members have been sending their troops and weaponries. The reason? They lie right along the border with Russia. Apart from military deployments near Russia's borders, the West has imposed several rounds of sanctions against the Kremlin. It seems the continued pressure on Russia could plunge the two sides into another Cold War era and throw them and their allies into yet another vicious arms race.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have Moscow-based international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda joining us from Moscow. Mr. Sloboda, welcome to the program. Well, Russia has warned NATO of further tensions if it deploys troops to the Ukrainian border. In your opinion, what would this troop deployment do to the already delicate situation now?
Well, if there actually was a deployment of NATO troops to non-NATO Ukraine during a heightened tension in the region, particularly with the civil conflict in Ukraine between the West-backed regime in Kiev that seized power there, overthrowing democratic elected governments in 2014, and the eastern Ukraine, the Donbas regions, which have refused to recognize that seizure of power in the ongoing frozen conflict. If NATO troops were actually stationed on the ground, even temporarily, that would inflame the situation, and Russia would respond symmetrically, asymmetrically, as it felt necessary to protect its own borders and national security.
Well, the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Russia would be forced to take extra measures to ensure its own security if the U.S. deploys troops in support of Ukraine. Unpack that for us. Help us understand it better.
Okay, so this present increase in tensions, if you want to call it the potential unfreezing of the frozen conflict in East Ukraine, was precipitated almost a month ago. I've been reporting on it since March 5th, that there was a worrying increase of Ukrainian Kiev regime forces sending conscripts, military gear, tanks, artillery, even ballistic missiles to the front in eastern Ukraine, to Donbas. This has been going on for some time, and there are a lot of domestic political reasons why Ukraine would seek a renewed conflict at this time. There is a political crisis in the country with the repression of eastern Ukrainian political representation and media. There is a constitutional crisis in the country between the president and the constitutional court. There is an economic and pandemic crisis, and the comedian turned president Zelensky's approval rating has sunk from 75% to 30%. In less than 2 years. That's where it's sitting right now. So a nice little renewed conflict rally around the flag patriotism would do a lot to resolve those domestic concerns. But also there's the question of Nord Stream 2, the gas pipeline, which would go underneath the Baltic Sea, another such pipeline, and reduce the need for gas to be shipped from Russia to Germany and the rest of Europe via the existing land-based pipeline structure in Ukraine and Poland. This would decrease Kiev's leverage over Moscow in their dealings with Europe, and it would also cut transit fees. Ukraine, a not insignificant portion of Ukraine's entire economy, is subsidized by gas transit fees from Russian gas shipped to Germany and the rest of Europe. The regime in Kiev sees the combination of losing these two vectors concerning the gas transit to be an existential threat. The U.S. has been doing everything possible, sanctioning Russia, sanctioning European companies, threatening, cajoling Germany. Lately, they've begun submarine and military exercises in the area where the last few kilometers are being laid under the Baltic Sea as we speak. And Ukraine and to a lesser extent Poland will really do whatever is necessary to stop a renewed military conflict in East Ukraine, even without any political resolution of the long-term frozen contract, would give Ukraine and the U.S. Additional impetus to push Germany to cancel this pipeline, to end it before it is completed. And I believe that that may be a principal reason for why Ukraine has moved so much military gear to the east. All the Western mainstream headlines are focused on, in the last few days, Russia increasing its own military forces in response in Western Russia on the Ukrainian border. A great deal of that was a pre-announced military drills that occur regularly in the spring. But the New York Times has been reporting that some 4,000 Russian troops are lingering a little longer. And that's what all the hubbub is about, 4,000 troops. It has to be said that 4,000 additional troops on the border is not an invasion force. I mean, let's be serious here. No serious military analyst will suggest that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is on the table, at least by the forces that are on the ground now. But it could be seen as a message to the regime in Kiev not to renew military conflict against Donbass in East Ukraine, or you know, Russia will continue to provide assistance to the people of East Ukraine to secure their political and social rights.
All right, also joining us now on this debate, we have political commentator and analyst Michael Lane, who's joining us from Washington. Mr. Lane, it's great to have you with us. First of all, allow me to get your perspective on what's going on right now, what this troop deployment could mean to the already volatile situation there.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the chance to be here. Some of what I say may agree with what my colleague, Mr. Sloboda, just said. We had some technical issues getting set up here, but the last minute or minute and a half of what he said sounds somewhat familiar with my own thinking. What's going on here, I think, is a multifaceted circumstance. The first is that the Russians still are continuing to press and assert their claim to help the dissidents, the insurrectionists, if you will, in East Ukraine, as they press to have their semi-autonomous or even attached to Russia kind of circumstance going on, a significant portion of them being ethnic Russians. The second thing that's going on, and I heard Mr. Sloboda talking about this, and I think I agree with what he said, if I heard it correctly, is that we're talking about the pipeline. And this has been controversial, and Mr. Trump's administration did everything he could to get the Germans to reverse their decision, and indeed the Europeans to reverse their decision of relying to whatever extent on Russian oil. Ukraine was in concert with the Trump administration. But the idea of having this troop movement in the general area certainly puts pressure on the NATO coalition to come up with some resolution and allowing the completion and use of the pipeline would be one of the objectives that Russia would have. The third thing that Putin is doing in the beginning of any American administration, our adversaries on the world stage are always in a position to test us, to probe, to poke, to see what they can do to find out what the reaction of the new president will be. Joe Biden has been in office for approximately 75 days now. Apparently, the Russians have decided that it is time to do that poking and probing, see how he will react to this particular thing. So I think a significant, measurable portion of these troop movements that we've seen or that have been alleged are associated with that testing Mr. Biden and see what his reaction will be.
Back to our guest in Moscow, Mr. Sloboda. Ukraine has accused Russia of systematic aggravation of the security situation in Donbass and Crimea. Also, a NATO official claimed Moscow was undermining peace efforts in the rest of Ukrainian region. Is Russia really the threat that NATO says it is?
Well, this is, of course, rather Orwellian response coming from the regime in Kiev as it has been bringing military gear up to the front in eastern Ukraine. If of course they are the destabilizing influence there. They have also, going on 7 years now, there's a reference to Crimea. What they're talking about there is that the regime in Kiev built a dam to cut off the flow of water to Crimea, to punish the people of Crimea collectively for choosing wrong to get out of Dodge after the government they elected to Kiev in 2014 was overthrown and reunify with Russia. This water deprivation, all right, water is an essential for life, is of course a crime against humanity. It's a crime against humanity whether Israelis do it to Palestinians, whether Turkish-backed Islamics in northern Syria do it to U.S. Kurdish proxies there, or whether a West-backed regime in Kiev does it to the people of Crimea. That certainly has led to tensions there, accusations that Russia will seek to resolve the conflict by taking over that territory or destroying the erected dam. That seems unlikely to me. Russia has begun a mass desalinization program to solve the problem. But you see a continual pattern of Kiev's political destabilization. They refuse to enact even the most basic of the Minsk protocols, which requires the leadership of the regime in Kiev to sit down with the political authorities in Donbass and begin a political reconciliation for their country. The West-backed regime in Kiev refuses to do so because that would challenge their narrative of how they seized power in 2014 and the potential that the loss of legitimacy, quote-unquote, would lead to their whole house of cards collapsing about them. So that is the real destabilizing situation there. Is Russia a threat to Europe? I mean, it's just absurd. I mean, the U.S. alone, right, spends more than the other top 10 military spenders in the world, most of which are U.S. allies, by the way, put together. And all together, U.S. and the rest of the European NATO allies outspend Russia on military spending every year by some close to 12 to 1. Russia is not a military threat to the U.S. or to Europe in anything in conventional terms outside of a strategic nuclear response where there is indeed parity.
Sure. Michael Lane, we have to look at what the new U.S. administration is bringing to the table. So far, it's been trying to pressure Moscow. Now, if Washington's method is to further antagonize Russia, how will that feed into NATO?
Well, again, this is the reverse. If President Putin was doing his best to test President Biden and see how he would react to certain circumstances, then President Biden would certainly be within his scope of expectations to do the same test and see what Putin would do. I think ultimately, Joe Biden sold himself as a president who would, to use a anachronism, world peace. You know, he's the guy who's going to get along with everybody. We're all going to be friends, kumbaya. So he doesn't want really any conflict with Russia. But he wants very much to be seen as the guy who stood up to Putin when he had his first test, so that a message can be sent around the world. Okay, this was the, you know, this was my reaction. I stared Russia down. Therefore, nobody else, please test me. Hint, hint, Venezuela, North Korea, perhaps even the government of Iran. So that seems to be Putin's motivation. I would say one thing about what Mr. Svoboda just said in terms of if Russia is a threat to Europe. No, in an all-out war, the combined forces of Europe and the United States and NATO and all that would certainly prevail in a military conflict over Russia. But, you know, Putin is much more sly and much more clever than that. He picks and chooses spots. He goes after little pieces here and there. For instance, back in 2014, when the military might was roughly the same, he limited his take at that point to the Crimea. You know, so what did Obama did? Well, essentially nothing, because Putin gambled and won that Obama wasn't going to risk anything over Crimea and whether or not it belonged to Russia or the Ukraine. So Putin, you know, possession being 90% of the law, Putin has the Crimea now. I don't see a path to it ever going back to Ukraine, notwithstanding arguments to the contrary. There are other areas in Europe, the Baltic countries, where threats could be made, and Russia, again, one-on-one or one-on-three against these countries would be a very significant force against them. But Putin will be very, very careful not to push the buttons that will result in an all-out conflict, because he knows that simply is not in his interest. That's not what he wants to do. He wants to control the Ukraine so he can be right up on the border of NATO and be a more constant needle in our arm than he can be now.
And one last question for you. Mr. Lane, the increasing tension certainly it has something to do with the dip in U.S. relations. Apparently, it's the lowest of lows in recent memory. Where does that leave the issue of Ukraine, then? What is a way to bring about a peace to the conflict?
I don't think there is a way to bring about peace to that conflict, short of the insurgents in the eastern Ukraine deciding they're not going to pursue that anymore. Ukraine claims that territory as their sovereign territory. They don't have an option of abandoning it or saying, okay, we're gonna put you off and you can be your own region. That's part of Ukraine's territory. They will be seen as vacillating, weak, and defeated if they were to do anything other than continue to stake their claim on it. On the other hand, it's President Putin's advantage to continue to see destabilization in that region,